Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, as we do every Monday morning. And we've got a bunch of other stuff we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about hosting Saturday Night Live, the worst SNL hosts of all time. It was a pretty terrible show this past Saturday with Kit Harington. And we're going to talk about some of that. And Adam Sandler has been announced as one of the hosts, and so we're going to talk about that and much more. Food combinations that shouldn't exist. It's also Jackie Chan's 65th birthday, if you can believe that. And I'm sure he's celebrating by, like, jumping off of a building or something. But it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski join me to talk about the new movies. And we talk about the box office as well. So we'll get into that here, as we do on every Monday morning. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. So let's welcome the guys to the show. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Jim. Welcome back, Jim.
Hello there.
Yes. Jim, you actually had you did an interview for your podcast this past week, right?
Yeah. So one of my favorite actresses working today is actually in a movie we're going to review later on, and I had the immense pleasure of talking with her on Voices and Visions for a good 20 minutes about, you know, horror and her history and what it's like being cast in Pet Sematary. Her name is Amy Simetz, and if you look at her credits, they're quite impressive. She's directed episodes of Atlanta, co-created the TV show adaptation of The Girlfriend Experience. And for me personally, she gave one of the all-time great performances in a movie that I absolutely adore called Upstream Color. So to talk with her is kind of an honor for me. So it was a blast to interview her, and people can check that out currently over at voicesvisions.net.
All right. There you go. And we'll be reviewing Pet Sematary in just a little bit. So there you go. All right, you guys. Am I the only one that's, like, insanely excited for Fossey Verdon? I'm losing my mind.
No, I'm excited.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say, man.
Yeah, the movie could be called Jack and Jill as long as you tell me Sam Rockwell and Michelle Williams are in it.
Yeah,
I'm there.
It's just ridiculous. It's gonna be. I hope it's good.
Oh yeah,
I really hope it's good. So anyway, I'm sorry. I clicked onto the IMDb and that was the first ad that it was the first ad that popped up, and I saw it and I was like, oh yeah, that's right. It premieres tomorrow. So
yes.
All right. Well, let's start here. Jim, why don't you tell us about Ash is the Purest White?
Okay, well, yeah, this is a really interesting film from a fascinating Chinese filmmaker named Yang Zhangke. Hopefully I pronounced that right. And this time he's decided to explore the mafia underground starting in the early 2000s. And it's basically covering what a life in crime does to a particular relationship between very complex people. The woman here, her name is Chiao, and she sports a very Mia Wallace haircut in the beginning, similar to her character in one of this director's other films called Unknown Pleasures. We first meet her at a nightclub in Datong circa 2001, and she's very devoted to this heavy mafia guy named Bin, who has ambitions of becoming a kingpin, of course. He wants to rise in the world of crime. Chiao and Bin are very close to the point where they can finish each other's sentences and share cigarettes, and they're able to de-escalate most eruptions of tension among the bad guys circulating the group. So she's really good at keeping the peace, all while making sure her activist father doesn't get into trouble. Until one evening, a really intense fight breaks out in the streets, and Bin tries to take on an entire gang using only his fists. Eventually, he's becoming bruised and bullied and pummeled. So Chiao actually takes out his gun gets out of the car and fires it into the air. And while simply firing or just possessing a gun is forbidden in that country, and instead of informing the police that the gun wasn't hers, she ends up taking the fall and serves 5 years in prison. We then cut to years later where we follow her on this quest to find Ben, which, you know, initially this is someone she thought she was the love of her life. But he has since disappeared after she went to jail for him. So the rest of this film is more of a meditation, you know, kind of while we sort of follow this lead character. And it's really, really kind of an enveloping film because we're also really exposed to, like, just how much, you know, the world of China is changing even just in a span of a few years. You know, so that's pretty much the gist of it. The filmmaker really is an interesting one, and he's the type who assumes that you can sort of fill in the blanks and kind of concentrates on the more intimate moments, kind of reminding me of like Wong Kar-wai mixed with Antonioni, especially with the pacing at times. It starts off really energetic. There's this really cool extended use of the song YMCA that puts it in a really joyful context, but it's later contrasted, and I think that, you know, you think of a, like, mafia movie, you kind of go, oh, well, you know what to expect, and in the beginning, it's like, oh, this is kind of like a flashy Scorsese movie, but then it pulls the rug out from, you know, out from under you, and it becomes a more thoughtful film, a much more differently paced film about, you know, 40 minutes in or so, because you're really just sort of on, you know, on board with this woman as she's, you know, sort of trying to figure out her path in life and also try to reconnect not only with her long-lost love, but also just the world of China as it's changing. And I think that's really what this filmmaker is really interested in, not only just like the intimate storytelling and character studies, but just how culture changes and how time passes. You know, some people are saying this is one of the best films by this director. It does touch on familiar themes and feelings that he's captured in other films like Still Life, which probably is my favorite of his. And it's, you know, not unlike something like, in terms of the pacing, like his last film, Mountains May Depart. I think for people who are familiar with this director's work, they'll definitely check this out regardless. And I'm definitely recommending it because, like I said, I was really, I wound up very involved with the story. So if you want a unique take on the Chinese mafia, but mainly focused on a woman and her journey to reconnect, I think you'll be very happy that you invested the time. It's well worth a look, and I believe it's playing at the Landmark Century and the Arclight.
Yeah, it's playing at River East as well. So there's three places you can check it out. All right, well, there you go. All right, let's move on. Eric, why don't you tell us about Shazam?
Okay, well, this is the latest effort from the DC side of the aisle as far as all the comic book versions, adaptations that we've been getting lately. Many people might, some people from my generation might remember the live-action television version of Shazam back in the day. But this one is much more polished, and it stars Asher Angel plays a young man named Billy Batson. He was sort of orphaned at a young age. He lost his mother at a carnival. He's kind of been living around the foster scene for several years, despite trying to locate whatever happened to his mother. He ends up in a new foster home that is sort of privy to taking in a lot of foster children. So he has a number of new brothers and sisters. One of them is sort of played by Jack Dylan Glazer, sort of kind of obsessed with superheroes and all the you know, all the baggage that comes with them, their powers, their weaknesses, and all that kind of stuff. And one day, while riding the subway train, Billy is actually transported off to a wizard's lair, where played by Jaimin Hunsu, and he is looking to pass along his powers so that they just, you know, the force of evil can be kept at bay, and it can be given to someone who is pure at heart and is not going to be tempted by the bad forces that have surrounded the wizard. and his lair for much of his time. So he ends up choosing Billy, and whenever he says the magical word Shazam, which is actually an anagram of many of the sort of the powerful figures of Greek mythology, he is transformed into a superhero, a older superhero, so sort of shades of Big applied to the film, and he goes about testing his superhuman powers, and while not exactly sure what might be in store for him, but there's also another person played by Mark Strong, who in the prologue many years ago was actually offered the wizard's powers, but he was a little more attuned to the temptations of the monsters that are personified by the seven deadly sins, and he was not chosen and spent his entire life trying to track down these powers.
Okay,
so,
all right, confrontation. Hang on, Eric, hang on, okay?
Okay.
We got to take a break. Okay. Guys, hold on. Eric and Jim are here. We're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll hear more about Shazam from Eric. And we got other movies to review, as well as check out the box office, too, right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about the worst SNL hosts of all time, on food combinations that shouldn't exist. And it's Jackie Chan's birthday. He's 65 today, so we're going to talk about some of his best movies. Speaking of movies, it is Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Jim Liskowski, Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. Before the break, Eric was telling us about Shazam. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you again.
All right. Eric, continue with your talking about Shazam here.
Yeah, so these two superpowers, super good and super villain, are headed for eventual confrontation. I forgot to mention that when transformed into the older superhero, it is personified by Zachary Levi, formerly of the television show Chuck, is probably what he's most known for. He also did the voice of one of the characters in the Disney film Tangled. But, so getting to, the DC Marvel wars, as they sometimes get to, Marvel has, sort of outpaced DC 2-1 in their output, and DC has, for, many of their films, sort of because of the Zack Snyder stuff, have kind of leaned on the sort of the dark, less fun stories of their, very famous characters. Wonder Woman was sort of a breakthrough for them with audiences. Many critics liked that one, and audiences clearly liked Aquaman, or at least they went to see it, even though that wasn't very good. But I was thoroughly charmed by this movie. I didn't know what to expect from it. I thought that it really had potential because of the tone that the film was setting for itself. I was a big fan of the television show Chuck when it was on, and have liked Zachary Levi in the past, and he's really good in this movie. He's really good, as just about everybody is in this movie. I think Mark Strong makes a terrific villain in this thing, and it's a film that, well, it has some scary stuff in there. The tone is decidedly light, and it's the kind of tone that, one of those rare occasions that actually sort of took me back to the types of movies that I really loved growing up. I mean, when I was a really young kid, I would have really loved this movie when I was a kid. And I had a lot of that sort of flowing through me while watching this thing. I really cared about what was going to happen to these characters. I really liked the real extended third act of this movie, the confrontation between Zachary Levi and Mark Strong. It has a really, you know, I mentioned Big earlier, it actually has a real nice shout-out to Big in the film that I thought was really cute and clever. There's so much about this movie that I really enjoyed. I laughed a lot. I laughed very hard during this movie. I really love the final moment of the movie. I thought that was hilarious. I just there was a moment during this movie where, during the climax, which I won't reveal too much what happens there, but I got up a charge. I kind of almost went yes in the theater watching this thing, and I didn't even get to say through the end credits for it, but I'm really looking forward to seeing this one again. I think this is a real great turning point for the DC universe, particularly because I think it's about the first good movie I think they've made, frankly.
Oh, okay. All right, I didn't get a chance to see that to see it. It did pretty well over the weekend, though.
Oh, it did quite well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, there you go. So Shazam gets a good review from Eric. All right. Jim, tell us about The Public.
All right. Well, this is the latest independent film from Emilio Estevez, who you probably remember from The Breakfast Club. Of course, he's also a writer and director. He's made films like Wisdom and Men at Work. I was a little curious, and we'll get to reasons why in a bit here. But this takes place in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it begins with this PSA about what it's like to pursue a career as a librarian. You know, and of course, during this PSA, they say, you know, it requires a love of both books and people. The subtext, you know, here, as we begin the story, of course, focuses mainly on the homeless community, because obviously they are people, too. And the story starts on a scene of a group of street dwellers waiting for the public library to open. And it's mainly due to the fact that it's winter and freezing cold outside. The library is essentially a warm refuge for those who have nowhere else to go. Emilio Estevez plays Stuart, kind of a, you know, low-key, meek librarian who, you know, credits books with saving his life at a time when he was suffering with addiction. So he definitely loves books, and he's surrounded by them, but he's also very fond of people. He knows all the patrons' names, talks to all the regulars, and, you know, and tries to do his best in, you know, in a very low-key job for the most part. He's also helped by Myra, played by Jenna Malone, who is kind of this idealistic activist of sorts in addition to being a librarian, and who in her first conversation with Stuart begins to chastise him for not taking public transportation or doing more good in the world to stay green. So after that, after we're introduced to our main characters, we get introduced to a couple of subplots involving Christian Slater as a mayoral candidate and Alec Baldwin as a hostage negotiator. We sort of learn a little bit about their personal lives. And then all these players are sort of set into motion one night when all of the homeless patrons decide to stage a protest of sorts. Since it is bitterly cold outside, they demand that they be allowed to use the library as a temporary shelter, since all the other shelters in the city are full, and they just want a place to keep warm. And of course, this eventually involves security and then the police and Alec Baldwin as a hostage negotiator, even though none of these patrons, of course, are doing anything violent or don't carry a weapon of any kind. They just want to stay in the library to stay warm. And of course, Stuart is caught in the middle between, you know, wanting to keep his job, but also his desire to help and assist the homeless community during this difficult winter. So that's basically the plot. And, you know, first things first, the main reason why I wanted to see this film is because I currently work in a public library. And, you know, not too long ago, I was asked by a patron, you know, exactly why libraries have become kind of a sanctuary for the homeless population. And there are a lot of think pieces that date back to a 2007 article that Estevez read which inspired him to sort of tell this particular story. So I know he has his heart in the right place, kind of like he did when he made another ensemble piece like Bobby. But really, the execution here is far too heavy-handed and preached right from the mouths of the characters to where none of them seem like fully realized human beings, and that's really a shame. I think the only one who comes across as genuine is the great Michael K. Williams, who is kind of the main organizer of this library protest, and he's probably the most rounded figure. But then again, his story is kind of sidelined by focusing on the non-homeless protagonist played by Estevez. It becomes a little bit of a vanity piece to some degree when it's focusing, on the librarian as opposed to the homeless community as a whole at times. And also, he introduces, like, Christian Slater, in his struggles as a politician, and Alec Baldwin having a drug-addicted son. So there's just, like, a little bit too much, too many cooks in the kitchen here, so to speak. And, this is a really important issue, and I think, even the way he decides to approach this material, he kind of underplays it, even for comedy, in the final minutes, that I kind of thought was a little insulting, to be honest, even if he had good intentions by, trying to find humor in these circumstances. But at the same time, if people see this movie and have an interesting conversation that, revolves around something I personally experienced, then, I think it's, okay. But as a movie and as a script, it's pretty self-righteous and very ludicrous at times. I think he's fighting the good fight here, but I almost think that the subject matter would be better explored as a documentary. I really do. I think it would be interesting to sort of almost have like a mini-series or something about all the people who are suffering or struggling out there, especially when it's bitterly cold outside and they need a place to stay warm. So as much as I want to champion a movie that takes place in a library and does have something vital to say, I just can't recommend the public because it could have been done a whole lot better.
All right. Well, there you go. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Jim are going to hang on. That's The Public, not recommended by Jim. We'll take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to review the latest Stephen King adaptation, Pet Sematary, latest version of that. All right, and we'll do that right after the break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the worst SNL hosts of all time. We got some food combinations that should not exist and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. And you can talk or text us there, 312-981-7200. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski join me to review the new movies. And then Eric sticks around and we talk about the box office. Got one more movie to review this week. Let's welcome Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
None of us got to see The Best of Enemies, which is the new Taraji P. Henson and Sam Rockwell movie. And I've only seen the trailers, and it looks kind of interesting. But it seems to me that Sam Rockwell's kind of playing the same role he played in Three Billboards.
It kind of looks that way,
but I don't know. I have not seen it.
Well, in fairness to his Three Billboards character, he wasn't in the KKK.
Well, that's true. He
in
wasn't.
Fairness.
He wasn't. He couldn't. He certainly qualified. But anyway.
Or did he? I think that's debatable.
Yeah, there you
but
go.
Anyway,
we got that. That came out this week as well. But the latest horror movie here for the year of 2019 is another adaptation of Pet Sematary, the Stephen King novel. Eric, tell us about Pet Sematary.
Okay. Well, I think most people are aware of what the plot of Pet Sematary is, whether you are a fan of Stephen King's book or even you're just familiar with the 1989 adaptation, big screen adaptation by Mary Lambert, people know this is a story of a family that moves into a new country home for the father's job, who's a physician at a local school, and they live next to a very dangerous road where a lot of semis are speeding through for some reason. They have a kindly old next-door neighbor named Judd Crandall, and across the way, there is a pet cemetery where all the local children go to place their deceased pets. But beyond the pet cemetery is an Indian burial ground where you put stuff in there, and, well, they come back a little different. So, you know, people are, you know, are familiar with the story. Know that tragedy is going to befall this family in a number of ways. First, they lose their cat, and then things get even more sinister. So, you know, we don't need to spend too much time on the plot, because I want to spend more time on everything else about this version of Pet Sematary, which I actually found to be quite the travesty. And I'm saying that as someone who actually never got around to reading King's book, but I am very familiar with it, as I am the different interpretation from the 1989 version. Although this one, directed by Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Vidmeyer, who directed a film a couple years ago called Starry Eyes, that I felt was kind of a one-joke note type horror film, even though a lot of other people kind of praised it. They've taken their own liberties with the story, but that's not where my issues really lie with it. I'll get to those in a second. I was struck very early on with this version of just how, not just how bland it was, but just how kind of ineptly conceived and how rushed it seemed to feel. I mean, this is the story where, you know, we're in the sort of potential new Stephen King renaissance now, given that It was such a huge success, and a number of his old films that have been were adapted in the 70s and 80s are going to be remade, you know, shortly. It Chapter 2 is coming out later this year as well. So it seemed like, you know, everyone's sort of getting a second chance to sort of correct the errors of some of these old works. And, you know, the Mary Lambert's version was not particularly good. I think it was, at the time, I thought it was okay. Watching it recently again, a little bit less so, mainly because the acting is pretty terrible in it, aside from Fred Gwynne as the kindly neighbor, Judd Crandall. He's played in this version by John Lithgow, and I think that they kind of do him a big disservice, not just by, again, not including the character's wife in the film, which is also not in the 1989 version, but it just seems like his, even like one of his big monologues in the movie, they decide to cut away from John Lithgow and do a voiceover narration instead. That kind of reduces the impact of the narration that he's given. And, you know, like, you know, The Shining was a story about alcoholism that was famously kind of, you know, shuttered aside by Stanley Kubrick, but, you know, made his own very interesting version out of that story. But Pet Sematary has always been a story about grief and death and discussing it and the after effects and how grief and sorrow is something that just never leaves you. It's just, and it just kind of grows in the same way that, like, revenge grows, and those seeds that are planted in you are just hard to get away from, and it helps to motivate these characters' behavior. And this film, while it sort of touches upon a few things that are in the novel that Mary Lambert's version kind of shuttered aside, again, it all feels like it's on speed dial at times. There's so many instances where it seems like they didn't read the book, but actually just saw the 1989 film version, and we're doing a book report off of that. This film actually manages to be shorter than Mary Lambert's version, yet it feels twice as fast and yet twice as slow. This is a movie that doesn't have a great sense of dread to it, which I thought was something that the Lambert's version did have at the very least. I was not scared by this version. I think the changes they make to the story in the you know, at the end of the second act and through the third act do a disservice to the sort of sad creepiness of what King initially envisioned. And I got really angry at this film, first at the incompetence of it, and then that it sort of failed to deliver on everything that this movie is supposed to be about, and then ultimately it just not being very scary. I mean, so many of the scare scenes in this movie, I think all of them, sort of come down to what I was calling in the theater, look, there's another squirrel on the roof. It's just someone walks into a room, they hear something on the roof kind of pitter-patting around, and that's going to lead to the big scare scene, which is not particularly scary to be at all. I really kind of hated this movie, and I'm going to be stunned if this movie actually doesn't end up on my worst list at the end of the year. I was really shocked how much I disliked this movie.
Wow. All right. All right, Jim, go ahead.
Well, I will definitely say that I was quite disappointed as well. I don't know if I disliked it quite as much as Eric did, but at the same time, yeah, I would definitely concur that this is one of Stephen King's scariest books, with kind of a jaw-dropping ending. And you know, it's the kind of story that kept me up when I first read it and gave me nightmares. Probably because I'm a cat guy and I've always had cats in my house. But this latest version, it's hard not to give away kind of the two major changes, and I obviously won't. But, the directions that the screenwriter decided to take, I don't know. I didn't buy it. I just didn't. And Eric's definitely right in the pacing. It felt off to me for most of the running time. It just didn't feel like it had a pulse. No pun intended. But it's just, I wasn't a huge fan of Mary Lambert's take on this material, despite obviously thinking, Fred Gwynne was pretty much perfect as Judd, and I definitely think Lithgow is a highlight here, but yeah, the way the story sort of plays out, I found to be kind of ridiculous. And Gage here is more of a an afterthought, which I thought was a bummer. I know why that is, but what it comes down to too is I just didn't find this version to be particularly scary. It felt muted and off-key to some degree. I think there are really good scenes involving Rachel and her memories of taking care of her sister. Of course, I really loved Amy Simons, as I always expect to anyway, but I didn't really think Jason Clarke, I didn't think he was that strong here, and I just didn't get emotionally wrapped up. As and this is a story about grief, like Eric said, and that's something that usually hits home for me in a lot of ways. I just felt this was a pale imitation of, really great source material that I've yet to see done right on screen. And I do think that there is a little bit too much awareness from these filmmakers of the 1989 version that's buried in there, especially once something occurs late in the film. I didn't think it was horrible because I liked a couple of performances, including Jette Lawrence, who plays Ellie. And, there's a couple of creepy flashbacks that I found effective. But overall, I just didn't get as scared as I'd hoped to be. And, I love the book so much that maybe there's no way I'm going to enjoy a version of this story on the big screen. So I can't recommend this updating of Pet Sematary either.
All right. Guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of Pet Sematary right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. And we'll be right back.
Some that you recognize, some that you hardly even heard.
everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on a Monday morning, here until 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Got a lot of other stuff coming up here. Before the break, Eric and Jim both gave their reviews of Pet Sematary. They both disliked it. Eric really, really disliked it. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. I am absolutely, completely on the opposite end of both of you guys. I thought this movie was great. I thought it was really scary. It's my favorite Stephen King book. I think it's the scariest thing he's ever written. I thought the Mary Lambert version sucked. I thought it was terrible. But I thought the changes that they made in this one were really cool. I liked what they did. And there's a couple of major changes, as you guys know, that they've made from not just the Mary Lambert version, but, you know, the book itself. By the way, got okays from Stephen King. He's a fan of this version. I thought it captured what was really deeply twisted about that book beautifully. I thought Jason Clarke was terrific. I thought everybody was terrific in this movie, especially the girl. The little girl is unbelievable in the movie. She's fantastic. Jetay Lawrence. She's fantastic. I thought what the book is really about. You guys are talking about grief. You guys are talking about how people deal with death. I thought that was absolutely at the forefront of what this movie really is. And I think there's a real sense of dread throughout the movie. I think it's a really scary movie, like a really, really scary movie. And it got under my skin the way the book got under my skin. I really thought Jason Clarke did a really great quiet job, showing the desperation of what happens to this character and how he deals with, you know, the losses. I thought the cat was fantastic. I loved the cat. Lithgow does a great job here. And I thought the atmosphere was really cool. I thought it was really creepy. All of the stuff with Rachel and her sister is as effective as it was in the book, and not as cartoonish as it was in Mary Lambert's version. There was a real sense of terror in that. Every time that she would have like a nightmare or a flashback concerning her sister, I was hooked. And you know, there's some dumbwaiter stuff in here that I thought was really, really scary. I was on board 100% for this, and I actually thought it was really scary, and it definitely got under my skin big time. I was creeped out by it, and I think it's a really darkly twisted movie in the same way that the book was really darkly twisted and really, really just kind of a screwed up, just a very screwed up movie and a screwed up book. And I thought they captured it perfectly, and I think it's really scary, and I think it's really good, and I think it. I love the changes that they made to the story, and I'm on board 100% with this movie. I thought it was great. I actually thought it was really, really great. So, I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not think you were going to like this movie, Nick. No, when I was watching the movie, I was thinking of you, thinking of this tonight. And the thing that I thought was going to put you off was not so much the changes and that, but I just thought that the film is so flaky. It feels so off the entire movie, not in a good way. Because the stuff with the sister I thought was so forced into the film. Like they kept going, like, oh shoot, we forgot to put that in. Let's put that back in. Get that back in. That's how that kind of felt the entire movie to me. I thought Jason Clarke was pretty terrible in the film. I don't think they even knew what to do with the Victor Pascal character in the slightest. He's just kind of a jerky ghost in the movie. The whole movie, I could not wrap my head around what people saw in this movie when they saw it out of South by Southwest. I mean, I went in so interested in this movie just to see if they were going to tackle that stuff that Stephen King, put into a story. And people might forget, he actually wrote the screenplay to the 1989 version.
Yeah.
So any butchering of that film, he actually did himself.
Right.
I the whole way through, and at the end of the movie, I was just like, oh, jerks.
No, man.
That last moment, I was just like, you know.
No, I thought it was great. I thought it was great. I even like the new version of the song.
You did? Yeah, I do.
No, I do. It's not the Ramones.
Space Crawler, whatever the name of the band is.
Yeah, I liked it.
Redoing the Ramones song.
Yeah, I liked it.
Oh, I'm telling you,
I thought this movie was great. I thought it was really, really scary and deeply twisted. And I'm with it, man. I'm like 100%. I'm 100% on board with this movie. I'm not kidding.
I think they just took Stephen King's book and script and buried it in the sour ground, and it came out crappier.
Yeah, I totally disagree. So, all right. Well, all right, Jim. Thanks, man. Wait, what do we got next week? We got what's the big one next
Hellboy.
Week?
Hellboy.
Oh, Hellboy, and wait a minute, Missing Link, that's bigger.
Missing Link is next week?
Yes, come on, man.
Oh, man.
That's the one.
Yeah. I keep forgetting that that's Laika.
It is Laika, man.
It doesn't look like a Laika movie to me.
I don't know. I'm in, man.
Oh, sure, yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Once I was reminded it was Laika, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got that next week. All right, Jim, thanks, buddy.
Okay, thank you.
We'll talk to you next week. There you go. There's Jim. All right, Eric, why don't we jump into some box office here?
Okay.
So the number one movie of the week, which is not a real surprise, was, of course, Shazam. Did it do what people expected? Did it outperform or what?
I think it overperformed what the tracking services were saying. They kind of had it in the low 40s. I was thinking somewhere low to mid 50s, and that's where it ended up. It kind of increased in business over the weekend. It is the lowest grossing or lowest opening weekend in the DC universe. But, you know, it's Shazam versus Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman.
Right.
So, Shazam is kind of like the Ant-Man right now of the DC universe.
Right.
And so it came close to grossing what Ant-Man did, actually. And I think that this movie is actually going to have the kind of word of mouth that, like, the Spider-Verse film had. It has that sort of that level of, I didn't even talk about it, how I think this movie is a real kind of special movie about family and inclusion and all kinds of things like that. And it's got a lot of really positive messages for it. So I think families are really going to be on board with this one. And you might see the business grow a little bit over the next few weeks.
Okay. I'd be interested to see what happens. So,
yeah.
All right. All right. Pet Sematary, $25 million. That underperformed or?
No, that's kind of where people kind of had it. I thought that it could do better just because name recognition, and it just seemed like people were ready for this thing. I don't know if Paramount, you know, didn't do a great job advertising it or what, but it's $25 million is certainly not a terrible opening, but I mean, running the numbers on it, I'm actually curious if it's actually going to maybe not outgross the 1989 version.
Yeah.
Just looking at movies that horror movies in its sort of realm, I kind of have a sort of comparison to the remakes of Evil Dead and Poltergeist, which had really big drops in their second weekends. I think that there's a possibility that if this movie does make more than the 89 version, it's not going to be by much.
Yeah. Well, I thought it would make more than $25 million. I thought it would have a much bigger opening than that.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is Dumbo, $18.2 million, $76 million total. By the way, you were not here last week.
No.
I hated Dumbo.
Really?
I hated it. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet, no.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, people don't like it.
Oh, my God, I hate
it. And audiences apparently are not caring about it either.
Yeah.
Because this is a movie, the production budget was like $170
million. Jeez.
So this thing needs about $500 million to break even, and it's just over $200 million worldwide. This thing, you know, is behind the 10-day grosses of, you know, Wild Hogs, for God's sake, on the Disney line,
yeah.
And Lilo and Stitch, which grossed $145 million total. It's likely going to do less than that.
Yeah. I mean,
so,
yeah.
This is kind of a disaster for Disney.
Yeah. Number four is Us, $13.8 million up to $152 million. Is it gonna reach Get Out?
It's gonna pass Get Out.
Yeah.
Oh, it's gonna pass Get Out. The only question is and whether it's forging a path towards $200 million at the moment. So it's gonna be probably the second highest grossing horror film of all time behind It.
Wow.
Not too shabby.
No, not bad for his second movie. Number five, Captain Marvel, $12.6 million. That's still doing solid numbers.
Oh, it's doing incredible numbers. It's now the 30th highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's doing pretty well. It's reached $1 billion, and it just continues to climb.
I'm just happy for Brie Larson because I really like her.
Sure.
So that's that.
Yeah.
Number six, The Best of Enemies, $4.5 million. That's about what everybody would thought would.
Yeah. It was only released in 1,700 theaters, so you weren't going to get a huge number there. The critics were not weren't pretty mixed on it.
Yeah.
So I'm not expecting anything much larger than that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Number seven, 5 Feet Apart, $3.7 million. It's up to $41.5 million. I guess that's pretty.
That's a solid little hit. Yeah. I mean, a $7 million budget, and it's going to almost make $50 million. That's a solid hit.
Okay. And then Unplanned, $3.2 million.
Yeah.
Its total is at $12.4 million. Number nine, Wonder Park. $41 million. How long has that been out? 3 weeks now? 4 weeks?
Four weeks.
4 weeks.
Came out the week before us.
Oof. 40,
yeah.
Wow.
That's $100 million animated production right there.
Wow. And then How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, $1.9 million, $156 million. How much less is that than the others?
It's about $20 million less than the second film, about $60 million less than the first film.
Mm.
But it's over $500 million worldwide, and the film doesn't cost as much as, you know, some of these other films have. It's certainly no Wonder Park. It is definitely a hit.
All right. So you think Little is going to be the number one movie next week?
Oh, gosh. I don't know, honestly. I mean, I don't know what kind of taste people are going to have for Hellboy.
Yeah.
They tried this twice already, and both times it lost money.
Yeah.
And now Lionsgate it's the third studio to put out a third different Hellboy movie.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah. And this one's not Del Toro. I think there's some curiosity for it. I understand in a lot of markets it might not even be getting screened, or at least people aren't getting invites to it.
Right.
It's screening here in Chicago, so people are getting, there will be reviews of it.
Yeah.
I can't really gauge what Little is going to do too.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen a lot of advertisements for that.
Yeah.
And it's strange that, you know, Shazam was, you know, we had a superhero movie that was kind of like big, and next week we got a superhero movie, a comic book movie, and a movie that is basically big entirely in reverse.
Right. Exactly. All right. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens, man. All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week. Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski will join me again next Monday for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews and the box office as well. All right, we'll take a quick break right here on 720 WGN. Watch for Chicago's very own Stories with Micah and Joe, Micah Mateer and Joe Donlin, weeknights on WGN TV News at 9.